We're so happy to have Brother Tim with us, his lovely wife Dawn, our sister Dawn Tripper, from the Portland Ecclesia. And Brother Tim's subject will be the medieval ecclesia. Happy to turn this podium over to Brother Tim. Lord be with you.
Good morning. It's nice to be with you all. And for me, it's a special treat to be on the East Coast. I have roots on the East Coast. And to see you, see the groups from New Jersey and from Michigan especially, takes me back many years. We bring you the Christian love and greetings of the friends back in Portland, especially the family members that are back there, my parents, my grandmother, my aunts. I want to be especially remembered to you all. The medieval ecclesia. We know that each one of the members of the 144,000 will go through specific experiences, specific training in order to make him or her fit for the kingdom. But think of how different the development would have been depending upon which time period you lived in. First, consider the group that lived in the days of Jesus. That was an educational experience to be taught by the Master. That was an experience that could not be duplicated. The teaching, the lessons, the insights that Jesus could share. Then think of those who were trained by the 12 apostles. To have those inspired apostles teaching you, explaining things to you. Again, that was a rich educational environment. Now jump to this end of the age. We have been privileged to live in the harvest time, where the clarity and the sheer size of the truth that has been given to us has been incredible. Our understanding of the harvest message, the chronologies, the time features, this has made it a wonderful time in which to run for the prize of the high calling. But think of the time periods in between. What about those who ran for the prize of the high calling in the dark ages? We would call that today an educational and an inspirational deprivation. They were deprived to have to live in that time period. Today we are going to study a portion from church history, a dark portion of the gospel age. I'm talking about the Middle Ages. Was there enough gospel in those days to nurture a child of God? Was there enough food to sustain spiritual life? I think the answer is yes. It was an incredibly dark era. It was a wilderness. There was only a little candle flicker here and there. But as we look back through history, we can see where the true church would have been hiding. To be spiritually developed under such stringent circumstances would have been an incredible challenge. And I think there are some powerful lessons from the difficulties of those days for us to learn, for us who now live in the lap of Laodicean luxury. There are several scriptural foundations for the thought that there were spirit-begotten children of God throughout the entire gospel age. First, There's the logic of Revelation 18:4. The statement is, come out of her, my people. And the her being the great apostate church. To have a harvest time call of to come out of her infers that the true church before that time must have been inside the nominal system. Secondly, in the 12th chapter of Revelation, verse 6, the woman was forced to flee into the wilderness for the 1260 days. This would again describe the experience of the true believers. And we notice with interest that it says that she had to flee to a place that God had prepared for her. I think that shows that it was possible to survive, even though in an outcast condition. Thirdly, we picture the true church of the Middle Ages as being isolated in the desert, like Elijah. And like Elijah, the true church was fed by the ravens. 1 Kings 17:6 tells us that Elijah was fed with bread and meat. And additionally, we notice that Elijah was miraculously fed on two additional occasions, equally unusual and significant. The second time was 1 Kings 17:15, in the incident of the miraculous barrel of meal and the cruse of oil. And that also occurred during a period when the entire nation was starving. And then the third time, in the desert again, Elijah was fed by an angel in 1 Kings 19:5-8. As we look at history, in the Middle Ages, Rome was the dominant power. As Rome became more and more influential, the city's decadence and pagan heritage reached even into the church. The depravity reached such depths within the church that pious people rebelled. They were greatly dismayed. They were disheartened as they saw these things taking place in the so-called Church of God. As a reaction to all the troubles, to all the worldliness of the church, monasteries were founded. It was a reaction to the lack of principles in the church. It was a reaction by people who were trying to get away from the control of the mother church. So they withdrew. They left. They isolated themselves. And they refocused their lives on spiritual activities. They were trying to start all over again. They were trying to improve the Christian life. Now, in this short overview this morning of a period that's approximately 1,000 years long, let me jump to a conclusion. In this period of which we speak, this futile, depraved, economically destitute society, if there were any spiritual life at all, it existed in the monasteries. Yes, there were other churches, cathedrals, there were bishops in the cities and towns, but we're talking about the years 600, 800. Those churches were famous for their corruption, for their allegiance to the Pope, and to their allegiance to the local political rulers. And they were most famous for their immorality and their corruption. Could there have been spiritual life in the educational systems? Not quite at this early date. At this beginning of this time period, there were virtually only two or three universities in the world. There were no other educational systems in existence. So if someone wanted to be a student, especially of the scriptures, the monastic life was the only real alternative. The monastic movement began in the 6th century. And they made periodic waves of reform against the church. Various orders were founded. The founders were always a minority, but they always were sincere and pious. Perhaps the libraries were of the greatest interest to us. But also, there were other great efforts made in agriculture and art and other fields. But still, our hearts gravitate back to the manuscripts. You know, if it had been up to the rest of the world, if it had been up to the Mother Church and the political rulers, not only would reading and writing would have been lost as a skill, but all the literature and all the scriptures of the previous eras would have been lost. It was in the scriptoria, which is the Latin word for writing room, that the monks copied and thereby perpetuated the scriptures for us. As specific monastic orders lost the clarity of their original missions, again, the same process took place. Devout, pious Christians would see the problems and then would leave, withdraw from that monastery or that monastic order, and again start another order. 12 major orders came into being and were responsible for the creation of approximately 2,000 monasteries by the 12th century. For example, when the first order, the Benedictine Order of Italy, when they became in need themselves of reform, principled Christians withdrew and founded another order, the Second Order, in Cluny, France. This process was repeated time after time. One of the major problems that caused people to withdraw from the monasteries that existed was the direct and open conflict that they were having with the Pope. One of the most significant concepts of this time period is that not only monks lived in the monasteries. There were basically three groups of people who lived in this community. And I believe that there were men and women of God in each of these three groups. The first group was, of course, the monks. The average monastery had approximately 100 monks. The second group were the men and women who were not monks and who lived not within the cloister, but in the buildings surrounding the cloister. Frequently, they worked and lived within the boundaries of the monastery, and this group also usually totaled about 100 persons. These were married couples, craftsmen, workers, men, women, and children. It was a somewhat selected group, self-selected, because this group chose to live close to the monastery, but not as monks. The third group in those days was known as the pilgrims and strangers. This would number approximately 50. Transients, homeless, refugees, whatevers, who lived in the guest houses and in the hospitals of the monastery. So a typical monastic community would contain about 250 people. You know, that's not too different than the number of people that are gathered in this room this morning. There'd be 100 monks, 100 support persons, both male and female, and perhaps 50 transients. The 250 people would live in an area not too much different than this entire motel complex. They tried to isolate themselves from the rest of the world. They stayed there. They lived there. So obviously the spiritual life was not limited to the monks. The religious activities, the educational, and the interchanges included everyone in the group who had a willing mind. Now, certainly the monks had a unique opportunity. Within the monastery, some functioned as cooks, some took care of the stables, some were gardeners, some functioned as apothecaries, some as carpenters, some as masons. Now, on the average, they all spent 5 hours a day assembled in worship. 5 hours every day. They met together 9 times each day for prayer. Not just on convention weekends, 9 times every day for prayer. They were allocated 6 hours a day for their work assignments, be it the farming, the carpentry, the cooking, or the copying. And additionally, they were to spend 4 hours a day in private study and devotions. 4 hours a day in private study and devotion. That was 9 hours per day gathered for study, devotion, or prayer. Probably the best position was to work in the scriptorium, the writing room. That's where they copied the manuscripts. And to show you how elite this group was, this was the only room in the monastery that was heated. It was a very special work to be a copyist. It took one man approximately 1 year to copy a Bible. Actually, that's not very slow. When you consider the 66 books of the Bible in 52 weeks a year, it would mean about a book a week. And considering the equipment of the quills and the parchments, I'm sure that's where the word writing cramp was invented. Usually 50 monks would be employed in the copy room. So we see about half of the monk population was employed in writing, copying, perhaps illustrating, and some even researching. So far, where do we see the elements of the spiritual life? Certainly we see it in the 9 hours per day of study and devotion. Certainly we can see it in the work of the scriptorium. But was there, in this environment of Catholicism, in this arena where the Mass was performed, where on the wall the crucifix and relics were hanging, in the midst of this merry worship, was there room for debate? Was there room for discussion? Disagreement? Was there any room in this kind of environment for the truth? The answer, most assuredly, is yes. First of all, each day, all of the monks met in the chapter hall. It would be a room about half the size of this room. After reading, it was called the chapter room because they would read the rules of their order, their monastic order, each day. And after that reading, they would discuss the affairs of the monastery. First of all, it was a business meeting, but the record shows that secondly, it was a testimony meeting. And the monks would testify about their personal activities, their personal spiritual problems, and their questions. Additionally, these meetings are historically documented and famous for their doctrinal discussions and for their disagreements. They would read a portion of scriptures in these meetings and debate its meaning. Secondly, during the meals, while the monks were eating, one of them would read, frequently from the scriptures, and some orders allowed discussion regarding what was read. Thirdly, and maybe most importantly, there was the daily work in the scriptorium. The scriptorium was clearly the most important room in the monastery. Not only was it the only heated room, but it also had the most windows. Not only did it have the most windows, but it was the only room in the monastery that did not have stained glass. The glass in the scriptorium windows was clear. And I like that thought. They did it for the light. They wanted the light so the copyists could see. But I like the thought that in the room where the manuscripts were being copied, the light was clear. It was not filtered through their stained glass. It took exceptional skill to be assigned to the scriptorium. As we said, on the average, 50 monks would toil in this room. The youngest monks, those inexperienced, were only allowed to do simple marginal decorations on the manuscripts, or perhaps to draw the lines for the copyists. Other more experienced brothers would translate from the Greek or from the Arabic into Latin, and others were copiers. They copied borrowed manuscripts from other monasteries. They copied manuscripts that they wanted second copies of, and manuscripts that were wearing out. Each monk had a desk. In front of each desk was a podium, almost like a music stand, to hold the manuscript that was being copied. They had a piece of vellum, a piece of paper with a slit cut in it, a horizontal slit that would only show one line of what they were copying, so that the copier would not lose his place. What does that tell you about interpolations? It says they weren't mistakes. Another group of this scriptorium monks were assigned to read and to research and to study and to compile their own notes on specific topics. As all of this work was going on, the room was filled with discussion. They would discuss the passages that they were copying. They would argue. They had their own ideas. Like any group, some of them liked to work, and some of them preferred to talk. There seemed to be three major topics of discussion. First was Aristotle. This was a new subject for the 1300s, and it was in this era that logic began to first be applied to the scriptures. What they learned from Aristotle was to think logically in a step-by-step process and to make deductions. Now, this is very hard for us to imagine because we are so used to thinking in some sort of logical form. We're used to a logical presentation of the philosophy of the ransom. But remember, before the clarity of the harvest message, that logic and that clear presentation wasn't always there. In the medieval times, largely from this logic taught by the classical Greek scholars, they learned to put two scriptures together to come to a scriptural conclusion. So, as they discussed the book of Romans, some of Paul's logic started to filter through. And as they discussed the book of Hebrews, they started to talk about the meanings of some of the Greek words, much like we do today. And it was discussions on the subject of justification that 200 years after this time, the ideas were finally crystallized by what justification meant by Martin Luther. And remember that Martin Luther was a monk. So a lot of these ideas began in the monasteries. They began in the scriptorium. The second major topic was the book of Revelation, the Apocalypse. Their discussions in those eras were permeated with the black magic of medieval sorcery. They just loved this subject. They loved the dragons, the multi-headed monsters, the spiritism. They loved to talk about fallen angels and of super active devil. They were fascinated by the images of Revelation, and they spoke incessantly about the plagues and the last judgment. The third major topic of discussion. You're not going to believe it. And honest, I did not make this up. One of the major debates of the late medieval period was, when did the millennium start? Can you believe it? Had the 1,000 years started? When would the 1,000 years start? Some sincerely believed that the millennium started in the year 1000. That was in their lifetimes. They said, what else would millennium mean? Others said, don't you know anything about the scriptures? Don't you remember that at the end of the book of Daniel, and remember they had no chapter and verse in those days, so they couldn't say Daniel 12:12. They say, don't you remember at the end of the book of Daniel, it says, blessed is he that waiteth unto the 1335 days? That means the kingdom won't start until the year 1335. What's the matter with you? Can't you reason on the scriptures? And the debate would fly back and forth. Others said, can't it have to do with signs? Can't you see that the signs of the times, that the 1,000 years has to start in the year 313? Because that's when Constantine started the church. So 313 plus 1,000 means that the kingdom will start in the year 1313. Those were actual beliefs of this time period. They argued, they divided, they fought, they split over the doctrine of the 1,000 years. So, what have we tried to establish so far? We've tried to paint a picture of where some of the spiritual embers could have been glowing in the discussions of the chapter halls, in the dining rooms, in their personal study, in their discussions as they worked on the manuscripts. There was room for spiritual life. It was definitely a wilderness, but they could have been fed by the symbolic ravens. Certainly, the vast majority had little or no truth at all. The vast majority. The majority lived in error, and their immoral lives proved it. But still, the debate of Arianism versus the Trinity, the debate of two salvations, the logic of the ransom and the restitution intermittently rang in those damp walls of the medieval monasteries. In later times, universities were created and grew, and this allowed another avenue of independent thought for independent Christians. But in these early days, there were no universities, maybe just one or two, and thus the manuscripts, the intellectual thought, was found only in the monastic orders. For the non-monks, spiritual life was also possible, even though on a less academic level. First, those who lived in close proximity to the monastery had daily contact with the monks. They worked together, they talked together, and they worshiped together. Secondly, the monks made definite attempts at teaching the Bible stories and all the other doctrines to the lay people. Much, if not all, of the artwork of the church was intended to be illustrations for the purpose of teaching the laymen the scriptures. Thirdly, history records that Bible reading rooms were established by some monastic orders. Not all lay people were ignorant and uneducated. Frequently, the monks were hired to tutor the children of the upper class. These reading rooms, which actually had scriptures in them, allowed access to these manuscripts. Fourthly, the monks had families. I don't mean wives and children. Once in a while that happened too. But what I mean is the monks had parents, brothers and sisters, uncles and aunts, cousins and friends who lived outside the monasteries. If a monk had been enlightened to any degree with the Holy Spirit, he certainly would have shared his light and his doctrinal truth with those of his family and his loved ones. History records the efforts of these people who fought against the Mother Church. They were called heretics. They were seen as undermining the faith. Those who dared to disagree were persecuted. They were cast out. They were inquisitioned. They had their works destroyed. And more often than not, they were actually put to death. What can we learn from this? In the time remaining, I would like to summarize 10 suggestions for our day and age. Number one, let's not make the mistake of Elijah when he said, "I alone am left." In 1 Kings 19:18, he said that. And in fact, there were 7,000 at that time period who had not bowed the knee to Baal. Let's not make the same mistake by saying, "There could be no spirit begettal in the Dark Ages. We're the only ones who have that privilege." The scriptures were available in that time period. And this part of the lesson has to do with humility. If we think that we're the only ones who have the truth, if we think that our time period is the one, only one that counts, that's too much a focus on ourselves. That can lead to pride, and that can lead to our rejection by the Lord. Secondly, the second lesson is in regards to this age-old debate over the writings of Aristotle and the other classical writers. This is a question as to whether we should accept worldly writers or only church writers. You know, the Mother Church had an inordinate fear of worldly education and wisdom. But do you see what happened? Despite all their efforts, the truth survived. The truth survived the teaching of Aristotle. And as a matter of fact, we could say that by studying Aristotle, they maybe actually helped establish the truth from that mess of error. So don't be afraid of worldly education and writing. I'm not suggesting you make a career out of worldly wisdom. But if it's good and logical and God-honoring, it will support the truth. Take it for what it's worth. If it's not God-honoring, it can't destroy the truth. Truth is stronger than error. The truth will survive. God will defend the truth. The truth won't go out of existence. Number three. The elite who lived in the scriptorium, those who copied and studied, they developed an overemphasis on the future. It was interesting to me that probably the number one Bible study in that era was the book of Revelation. Now, it was good that they studied the scriptures, and it was good that they were interested in the final judgment, but to them it became an obsession. Every day they were seeing the plagues poured out. Every time somebody got sick, they said, "Aha, it's one of the plagues." So they were overconsumed with the future, and they were underconsumed with their daily lives. The same thing can apply to us. As interesting as the future is, as interesting as the prophecies are, the first priority is the preparation of the bride class, the preparation to be righteous and acceptable to the Heavenly Father. Number four, I was awed by the 9 hours they spent each day in study, prayer, and devotion. It certainly did not sanctify all of them, but in the spirit of Acts 17, 10, and 11, it was certainly a Berean effort. And without trying to rationalize our own lack of time, each day, we should certainly increase the time we spend on a daily basis in those areas. Maybe they were living in the Dark Ages, but they certainly surpass me in their daily expression of prayer, study, and devotion. Number five, the chronological debate is absolutely mind-boggling to me. You mean that's what they spent their time arguing about in the Dark Ages? Yes. One of the number one debates of the 13th and the 14th centuries was regarding the thousand years. And it's been one of the number one debates of the last half of the 20th century. I find it embarrassing that we have spent so much time arguing about the same thing they argued about in the Dark Ages. You know, we laugh at them, saying that they used to argue about how many angels could dance on the head of a pin. Ha, ha, ha. Brethren, we've had similar debates over similar insignificant things. For all of our expertise and 20th century wisdom, we've had some foolish debates. Number six, the era was somewhat devoid of love. There's no mention in the debates of the scriptorium or amongst the elite. There's no mention in the writings, no particular recorded discussion that they talked a lot about love. It almost seems to be a forgotten subject. But we see it in their lives. We see it expressed in the hospitals that they formed. We see it expressed in their teaching of the common people. But as something that they talked about, it's not documented. Now, we can't make the same mistake. In all of our sophistication of the 20th century, we cannot forget about love. It's got to permeate everything we do. 1 John 3:14 and John 13:34 tell us that it's that quality that will distinguish us. It really has to have a priority in our development and in our lives. Number seven, the scriptorium, the writing room, attracted the most intelligent of the monks. But historians also note that it attracted the most ambitious. It was honorable to want to work closely with the Word of God and the manuscripts. But notice, even back then, it was a temptation to the ambitious. Today, it is honorable to want to work with the Word and to desire to be a teacher in the church, 1 Timothy 3:1. But notice, again, the temptation to ambition that teaching and writing have. Number eight, even though the monasteries were founded because individuals saw errors and excesses in the Mother Church, and even as upright and honest were the intentions of the founders of these monasteries, the spirit of the world still worked itself into each and every order. You see, the devil eventually works his way into every Reformation attempt. The devil eventually works his way into every good work. That's a very serious lesson for us, organizationally and individually. Many efforts start nobly. Many consecrations start in sincerity. Many organizations, ecclesias, and projects start with good intentions. But it takes an incredible singleness of purpose to keep those projects untainted by the spirit of the world, and to keep that effort, whether it's group or individual, from ambition and from pride and from invasion by the adversary. Number nine, wealth became a problem. Despite the severe economic conditions that filled the world in the Dark Ages, despite the vows of poverty and abstinence, the monasteries eventually collected massive wealth. How did they do it? They were smart, and they were frugal. They collected money, gold, jewels, land, buildings, flocks, anything they could get their hands on. History says no one ate as well as the Benedictines. No one was dressed as well as the Benedictines. While the rest of the world was starving, the Benedictines, on the average, were grossly overweight. Do you remember the pictures of the medieval monks? These big, huge men? Yes, they were Benedictines. You don't see any pictures of thin monks. There's a lesson there. They lost the concept of self-denial. They lost the concept of self-sacrifice. The same lesson can apply to us. Even though most of us were born into poor families, our culture has allowed us and given us the opportunity to gain and accumulate significant personal wealth. The scriptures, such as Luke 12:15 and others, tell us not to lay up treasures on earth, and that a man's life is not measured by the abundance of his possessions. It's not appropriate to satisfy worldly appetites. We have better uses for our resources. Number 10. Lastly, and most importantly to me, the clear lesson of this time period is that salvation is not a function of the organized church. The medieval ecclesia was not a group. It was not a city. The medieval ecclesia was scattered individuals who had an individual relationship with God and with the truth. It was the truth that sanctified them. The truth sanctifies individuals. Today, I suspect the very same thing is true. The true ecclesia of God is not a city. It's not a group, but it's scattered individuals. The emphasis is on scattered individuals. Perhaps there's almost too much emphasis on ecclesia life, ecclesia studies, ecclesia fellowship, ecclesia witnesses. What needs to be more and more is individual studies, individual fellowship, individual witnessing. The ecclesia cannot make our calling and election sure for us. Do you see yourself as an individual with a strong personal relationship with the Heavenly Father? Or do you see yourself as a member of a group of sanctified people who have a relationship with God? Our relationship should be individual, should be personal, should be like a son. We cannot function as a set or a group. In conclusion, we've tried to present the suggestion that there were spirit-begotten individuals, though very scattered, who collectively made up the medieval ecclesia. Let the difficulty of their environment and the lack of support